But tonight it is my pleasure to introduce Rob Schmidt and Stuart Goodnick, Tai meditation teachers. Rob's been teaching since the 80s, is that right? And Stuart since the 90s. And they received their training from Tai founder Robert Daniel Ennis. Tai Meditation Center owns and operates this space here, Many Rivers. The title of the talk tonight is The Age of Reasons, The Falsity, Fragmentation, and Selfishness of Ego. So thank you.
Thank you. I need to remember the title.
And the blurb.
Well, that I don't care about. Thank you all for coming tonight. I wanted to just mention that this title that I need to refresh my mind upon, The Age of Reasons, plural, The Age of Reasons, The Falsity, Fragmentation, and Selfishness of Ego, I want to do an attribution. I was trained, academically trained, when I got my PhD, and you don't steal someone else's idea. So this title actually comes from a website, from one of my, run by one of my favorite spiritual science fiction authors named Alexei Panshin. I've been reading his stuff since 1968. And this idea that we're going to be talking about is something that struck me when I was happened to read his blog. The reason that Stuart chose this particular outdoor statue that you see here in front of you, the Buddha meditating frog. The reason that it's appropriate is because in his best three novels, Alexei Panshin's best three novels, he has a character, and it's an alien, named Torv the Trog, and he looks like a frog. But he's constantly speaking in these sort of Zen-like wisdom phrases, and so I didn't prompt Stuart to.
Yeah, I had no idea that that was.
He knew nothing about this.
Well, I don't think it's going to happen, but that's how things work.
That's right. That's how things work when you're doing it right. So, Alexei Panshin's a very good writer, and anyone who wants to. Connect with his website can just see me afterwards and I can link you up on that. He's someone who has striven to incorporate an understanding of some of the stuff we're going to be talking about tonight in his writing. And that's a fairly rare thing. In his case, from the Sufi tradition. So, that's the start. Are you going to go next or am I?
I guess I can go next. The title for the talk, The Age of Reasons, already bespeaks a plurality. And what we want to convey, as, at least as one of the ideas to explore this evening, is a different way of looking at the functioning of our minds or the functioning of our egos. And what we want to call into question is the lazy acceptance that we all have of the idea of a singular self or a singular I. We certainly are aware, and particularly when we are interested in spiritual work, that there's the notion of a higher self and ideas of true self. But the question at hand is, what is our self? What is the experience of self that we have on a day-to-day basis? What's our starting point? The challenge is that we all just are, by virtue of the language that we use, assume a singularity within ourselves. We assume that we are a single I. And the I that is manifesting today, the I that's listening to me at this moment, the I that I might you might introduce yourself as if I asked your name, feels and seems like it's the same I that was there 20 minutes ago or yesterday. We assume that it is the same I. We assume that there's a continuity. And the idea that we want to explore in part is that that's an assumption that may not actually bear out on rigorous self-observation or rigorous research into the nature of the problem. The tradition that we work in some of its expressions, will often talk about the human being as being a multiplicity of eyes. The classic example that is used in the fourth way tradition, the Gurdjieff tradition, to describe the state of the human organism is to liken ourselves to a carriage with horses and a coachman who, rather than oiling the wheels on the coach and keeping the horses well fed and making sure the reins are fitting properly, is actually in the neighborhood tavern drinking while the horses are hungry and the carriage is sort of beginning to fall apart. So the idea in the fourth way tradition is that ultimately what happens is our carriage is such that various passengers will come in and tell the driver where to go from time to time. There's always a different person sort of directing the carriage from destination to destination, that there's not a single person, there's not a single owner, there's not a single integrated self with a purpose or an aim that unifies one's experiences throughout the continuity of one's life. So, yet when I say these words, it seems sort of theoretical because we feel like there's this one I. There's this sense of I that feels very familiar. And even if I go to bed at night and set my alarm and wake up in the morning and shut the alarm off and decide I want to sleep another hour, I assume that it's the same I. So in our tradition, one of the challenges or one of the things to look at is to begin to study this functioning, study this organism, because what we want to understand is there really one I, or are there actually many eyes? Is the thing that calls itself I more of an illusion rather than a reality? Is it perhaps, you know, the technical term we use, a buffer, which actually keeps us sort of softened against the contradictions of the fragmentary aspects of our nature? So parts of us want to go in one direction, parts of us want to go in another direction. If they were actually to meet, the raw conflict would actually be rather painful. So we create this buffer. We rationalize. We let the organism move in one direction according to impulses and according to an eye that may be running the carriage. And in the next moment, if we do the opposite, we immediately create this kind of buffered explanation for why that was really what we wanted to do after all. And if we look at ourselves honestly, we can see that a good part of our internal life actually flows in this way. The challenge is to take this idea from an intellectual level, where I'm just explaining it and you can kind of theoretically see this, to actually begin to experience at a deeper level. And that requires an ongoing practice, an ongoing looking within, and a perspective that is outside of the operation of these various identities, in order to see or to begin to test whether or not this thesis is correct or not in our own experience. So any questions so far on this idea? I've got sort of laid out a basic concept here, or a basic idea. So I see some of you in the audience are nodding. Does that mean that you buy this already? That you because in honesty, it's an idea that's subtle enough. Like I said, you can kind of understand the contours of it intellectually, but to actually see that it applies to oneself is, in my own experience, a very shocking realization. It's not a pleasant realization. It's actually it's a kind of an unpleasant realization, because it brings us face to face with what in the fourth way is termed the idea that in our ordinary state of consciousness we can't actually do anything. We can't do anything because doing presupposes an ongoing aim or an ongoing will that has purpose, when if the real state of our experience is something more akin to a puppet whose strings are being pulled by external factors rather than by some integral self within that has purpose, then seeing that and seeing the illusion of the separate independent I that we all cherish melt away is not pleasant. And it's not something that is done in a spiritual context, or it's not something that one realizes without at least some support, the support being that there is help or there's a way to change that situation. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? Mm-hmm. Can you explain what you meant about the external influences?
Yeah.
Because I was just learning about this concept of cognitive dissonance and ego defense mechanisms, you know, and rationalization. I thought the way it was explained was, you know, the tensions were between the id and the superego kind of thing, and that was all internal.
Mm-hmm. First, you know, that sort of model is a particular psychological model, and we're using a slightly different model that doesn't necessarily have a one-to-one relationship between what is the id, what is the ego, what is the superego. You can kind of map them. So that's one point I want to make. We're describing, just like that model describes our internal experience, I'm describing a model that can be applied to our internal experience, and you can validate whether the model is useful or not. I won't say true or not, but rather useful, because useful means that you can use the model to affect change in oneself. But to get to the answer to your question, the idea here is that if we have these different eyes in ourselves, these different personas, and what I mean by that is, like, each thought is a different eye. Each eye has a set of thoughts, a kind of a feeling space, and probably tensions in the body associated with it. Some eyes can be powerful, some eyes can be fleeting, some eyes can be, you know, well represented in our mind, our hearts, and our bodies. Some might just be a habit, like scratching or something, you know, like just a little impulsive response. But they're all triggered by something. And the idea here is that the factors that trigger the presence of an eye are factors outside of ourselves or outside of something we can call ourselves, but rather factors that exist in the environment. You may have an experience at work. You may have see a friend and be in a good mood, or see someone who has offended you in some way and be in a bad mood. You may have an accident. You may be ill. Any number of these things can create the conditions by which we immediately associate into an eye. And if we look at the course of our experience, the sort of the history of our psychological selves, we'll see this long kind of flowing, changing series of states that are in equilibrium and in reaction to what's happening around us. So the difference between that and what we might point to as an ideal or a possibility in spiritual work is it might be possible to imbue ourselves with an ideal or an aim or a purpose such that we are the same regardless of what's happening around us. We are a calm, quiet center no matter what the flux of the universe is. And when we can achieve that inversion, which is not something that you snap your fingers and it happens, it's a product in our a description or in our practice, a product of intentional work over an extended period of time. But when we can apply that inversion, all of a sudden we take on a quality of sort of radiating out and influencing the world rather than being the subject of the world. Does that answer the question? Okay.
Any other questions at this time? Yeah.
So are these eyes like in our consciousness? Do we share these eyes?
Actually, we share them all the time. They're like infections, you know, that we communicate to one another. And in fact, an enormous percentage of what we take to be our own personal individual consciousnesses is the product of infection, using this metaphor, from another person. Just like little kids learn how to be human beings by imitating other people. We do that all the time, sometimes consciously, a deliberate emulation of someone we admire or wish to look like. And in many cases, completely unconsciously, because that's the model we see enacted, and we just naturally fall into doing that. But all these different fragments all these different parts arise through this, basically through emulation, through we're apes and we ape others, that is to say. And all these, you know, it can be something as obvious and as clear in your mind as your mother saying, "Look both ways before you cross the street." You know, that's one that a lot of people will share. And some people even can hear their mother's voice in their heads saying that. Or maybe it was their father or their uncle or whoever it happened to be. The first person who really sent that one into your consciousness. And so, these things do come from multiple sources, and we do share them in many cases with others. Now, often when you have, I don't know, say a brother and a sister, you know, siblings, they'll have reciprocal eyes, so that they end up having a particular relationship framed by sets of reciprocal fragmentary responses, mechanical reactive responses to each other, which get played out as children once established. And then later in life, when they, you know, people come together for a family reunion or something like that, and you find yourself, "There I am again. Oops, how'd that happen?" So it is indeed something that we share, but the sharing is complicated, both in terms of the differing ways in which emulation or mimicry occurs, as well as in the reciprocal creation of some of these habits. Sure. In relationship to another person.
So, and they also in our genes, do they come from our ancestors too?
Well, I guess there are different people have different answers to that question, and I don't have a definitive answer to it. Other people, instead of attributing stuff that seems to come, that is, you know, a baby is born and it seems to have certain habits already, yeah, before it can speak. And some people will say, "Oh, that's from a past life." That would certainly be a classic Buddhist analysis or response. And other folks, you know, make other claims. Our view is that it doesn't particularly matter exactly where they came from. The challenge that Stuart was just describing is to be able to actually see them. Actually see the operation of this mechanism without the usual buffers protecting the other fragments from the unwelcome experience of seeing another part of consciousness masquerading as the entirety of consciousness. That's the trick. Every one of these little voices in our heads thinks that it's the main one, it's the main deal. You know, and so you get the phenomenon of one voice in your head having one view, and then literally seconds later, a new voice will come up and disagree entirely with the previous voice. So there's an example that we can appreciate most readily. By which we can appreciate most readily this phenomenon of internal fragmentation. But Stuart, you'll note that Stuart made reference to the body and to emotions, and these eyes manifest in these realms as well. And those realms have their own rules, as it were. Each realm has its own nature, and so it can be quite complicated sometimes. So we have reciprocal, for example, reciprocal emotional mechanical responses in relationship to certain people. Oh, I can't stand the look of that guy. I can't. Watching him walk down the street makes my skin crawl. you know, that kind of phenomenon.
Yeah.
You know, and that's an example of an eye that happens to get called up in certain external circumstances, but there's no absolute reason why that has to happen. Or if it does get called up, there's no reason that we have to believe that that voice is true, is the truth. That's the process of identification. And that process of identification with the voices in our heads, the emotional reactivity, even with some of the stuff going on in our bodies that we assume to be purely physiological, all that stuff is the product of, we're suggesting for your consideration here, all that stuff is the product of a set of mechanical habits that magically masquerade as unity, when in reality it is fragmentation.
Yes.
And are you suggesting that fragmentation occurs during childhood? I mean, that this pattern is set during the voices develop and become mature?
Well, I think we would say that there's certainly lots of research, even in the psychological realm, about the growth of the ego structure, and that a lot of the basic patterns will get laid down in childhood. But I think we're also making a stronger statement, which is that this fragmentation is the nature of the egoic mechanism. That is how it functions. That is its nature. It's not that we have a problem because we've got broken egos and need to work them out and smooth them out and make everything harmonious. Is that the very nature of the discursive egoic mind and the process of identification is one that has this fragmentation as its foundation. So that's a little different a statement, because and that's a more provocative statement, because the answer is not fixing the ego. It's not going to therapy and working out the contradictions. It's actually...
And finding your inner child.
It's transcending that whole mechanism, or finding something else in ourselves, or bringing to the fore something else in ourselves that is beyond that functioning. Yeah.
What is the benefit to the ego to be fragmented?
Well,
that's a good question.
Yeah, that is a good question.
I'm not sure what the benefit would be.
I was thinking about that myself. Just thinking, we walk through this world and we collect a lot of information, experiences,
mm-hmm.
and I'm thinking about the creative process. And you were giving the example of actually looking at something from many different points of view. We have that ability
mm-hmm.
to say the problem could be this, that, and the other thing. So
it
helps us that way.
Yeah, I think that
should be creative.
I think that's a good way of putting it. I think our teacher used mm-hmm. to describe it as the ego, or we when we talk about it internally, we call it the android. You know, it seems like a person, but it's not real. The ego or the android actually collects data about the way the world works, and we can't survive in this construct of a world without that information.
Mm-hmm.
A child who is complete innocence, doesn't have this functioning, is helpless in the face of the complexities of the social world. So the ego provides information. The problem and the solution, in a sense, is that our relationship to the ego is not correct initially. Or maybe, or perhaps a better way to put it is it might be just simply developmental, that as a evolving being, it's necessary for the ego to essentially be the active force in our lives that drives us through its relationship to the outside world, until something in us can grow to the point that it can take over the functioning as the active force and utilize or use or assimilate the information or the data that the egoic structure uses without being sort of subsumed by it or sort of mechanically driven by it. So
The trouble is that the android gets in its fragmentation, in its many perspectives, it becomes the the locus for all this critical information that we need. But when we have the habit of identification, which is a stickiness that happens, an adherence to each fragment, we can't be like a good, workman and simply pick up the tool we need at one moment, use it for whatever utility it might have in that moment, and set it down because it's actually still stuck to my hand. Ooh, get off me! You know? But that's the experience that we have with identification. We don't know how to pick things up, put them down, and pick up the next thing in an appropriate and straightforward and entirely utilitarian way because of these habits. So that's why the question is a difficult one to answer. Sure, there are these perspectives that are useful to have, but we want to ultimately be able to use them and not be used by them. And that's the relationship that is lacking, for the most part, in our experience. The tools wag the dog. That's a mixed metaphor, but anyway, it's a funny one. Yeah, go ahead. There's a good example of what we're talking about right now. Really?
No, I was just thinking about stepping outside of yourself. You know, that's what you're trying to achieve, a situation where you can step outside of yourself and know whether this identity is driving you in that situation or not. You know, like
in a sense, that's right.
Like a mother ego, you know, like you have a certain expectation of how people are supposed to treat you. You know, and if it's not happening, then I've been out of shape. So if you could step out of the situation and say, well, that's really what's bothering me right now, then you can behave more rationally and calmly. And
the difficulty is that usually that next thing that's stepped back and judged the previous manifestation, the previous fragment of consciousness, is just itself as fragmentary as the previous one. That's why they all believe that they have the real grip on truth. And for a moment, maybe that's true, at least provisionally, tentatively. But it's really hard to shake the habit of gripping these tools longer than is appropriate. That's the tricky part that's very hard to see. And so you did point to something that's very crucial here, which is to step out of yourself. And that's where various forms of meditation, including our own self-observation meditation, is so critical.
Let me just underscore your point that as soon as you, in your description, stepped out of yourself, immediately another I came in with the idea that being calmer was better.
Right.
Well, no, you were saying that there's a medium, a neutral place, you know, that's neither intellectual or emotional, right? I mean, you didn't say that, but I was reading.
That's a fair.
In between. But when you're engaged with this I person you're talking about, that's your personality. Mm-hmm. That's who you are. You're the sum total of your experiences in the world.
Well, that's why.
It makes you unique.
I got that. I agree, but that's why I don't quite like the description of this other aspect of consciousness, this non-egoic, non-android aspect of consciousness, as one that puts aside emotion, or puts aside feeling, or puts aside thinking, necessarily. All those aspects. You can stop them, but that's not what we're advocating. That's not what we're suggesting. Is the optimal direction to go. In fact, these things can be incorporated into the consciousness, for example, of the baby who has no no little voices in its head because it doesn't understand language yet. The voices in our head is one of the primary telltales describing and defining at least one form, one major form of fragmentation. But it's not the only one. But that one is not available to a baby, and yet, as we said earlier, babies are born and they are instantly unique. They're already, you know, here with qualities and properties that are unique. Habits, even, that are unique.
Intuition
that is unique. And so the trick is to be able to, as Jesus said, become like a child and yet have access to all the information that we have been exposed to in terms of how to operate and function in the human world in a way that is both accommodating to the situation, that the circumstances we find ourselves in, but is also authentic to this inner experience that precedes that exterior experience. And that is no mean trick, apparently, because so few people manage to do it on an ongoing, consistent basis. Every one of us, I think, have experienced moments of this. You know, sometimes the planets line up and we get to experience authenticity. But the point that Stuart was making at the very beginning is that these things do not happen readily, except by happenstance. And what we want to do, we at Tayu want to do, is talk about and practice creating conditions such that we can actually change the operation of this fragmentation, not so that we expunge the fragmentation, so that we create links between the elements of ourselves. Just like, you know, we want, it's sort of as if we create a habit of cancer, all these cells going off in different directions and not cooperating. We want cooperation. We want coordination. We want to be able to express in these bodies, with all their incredible capacities, the incredible range and scope of experience and action, non-reactive action, that the great saints and mystics have demonstrated to us throughout the ages. And that's a pretty cool challenge. That's really fun.
How can you separate emotion and intelligence from this process? I mean, the brain is such a black box. You can't really shut that stuff down. I mean, you couldn't operate if you weren't working with that stuff.
Sure, but any model has boundaries in it that are useful. You know, they're nothing's absolute. So if we talk about emotions as being different from thinking, or sensation being different from feeling, that has a meaning in our day-to-day experience, and we can work with that. Technically, when we talk about the functioning, and when Rob was talking about the functioning of the organism, our claim to explore is that the organism has potentials and possibilities and access to inspiration at levels that we don't commonly experience. And so by harmonizing this organism, which is a fairly phenomenal thing that is not being used in an optimal way in our current state of conscious evolution, we can begin to partake of some of the possibilities that aren't ordinarily available. But that requires some work, because as the sort of the language of our tradition states, is that our bodies are and our bodies, hearts, and minds are misconfigured currently. But this idea is not unique to even the fourth way. It goes back to the Platonic tradition of, you know, wheels would have been wheels that are sort of moving chaotically, and the goal of work is to bring the systems into alignment such that something higher can be expressed through these organisms. And that is what brings purpose to our lives. That subjectively is experienced as an ever deepening sense of meaning. Yeah.
And the question was just coming up about what happens to one's sense of meaning or purpose when you start seeing fragments as fragments.
When you start seeing it, well, in one sense, it's kind of a twofold experience, which is on the negative side, it can be shocking to begin to see fragments as fragments, because what we have taken as the sources of meaning for ourselves often is tied up with what we're identified with. So the particular stories and feelings that we're most identified with, that most define us, that are our most closest sense of self, may come into question in this process. And that can be not only shocking, but can also lead to a kind of an experience of emptiness, which is not a bad thing, but it's an emptiness that one has the possibility of negatively identifying with. If one doesn't have something else as a support, which is the conditions that Rob was describing in a spiritual school, a spiritual community, a spiritual school, the system that the school works with, the ideas of the work, all provide a structure, or to use a Buddhist term, a refuge, while one changes or sort of relocates what is meaningful in one's life. Ultimately, when this work is the source of deepest meaning for one, when spiritual work is the most meaningful thing, everything else sort of, and all these conflicts and all these issues sort of fall away, because there's nothing then that happens to one that can't be fuel for one's work.
So the search for meaning is something that is relevant for us all. And people look for meaning in many places. And one way that you might think about how this works is, as the process, as one undergoes the process whereby one confronts the challenging truth that oh my God, this is true. This is real. This is a part of me that I had not appreciated was distinct from the rest of me. Then that is an acknowledgement, an experience of internal reality that is a relatively rare thing. Our practice is to make that a consistent thing. Boom, 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 instead of waiting for lightning to strike. And when we make that a consistent experience, that creates room for something deeper to emerge. And that's what people are looking for when they're looking for meaning, at least in my experience and belief.
Well, this is all resonating very, very much in what's been happening in my life. I lost my father in February. And the question I have for you is very interesting, because you're talking about the readiness for being able to do this sort of work, and developmentally as we age and going through different stages in our lives, how that actually, whether they're truly, what is ready, first of all, what part of us is ready for that experience to happen.
Indeed.
And then for a reverent experience to happen before you that is, you know, very deep, if you're able to have that, that actually really impacts one, you know, in a very big way, for to be able to really see one's eyes
yes.
blatantly glaring at you in a positive way, But so my questions are, is it readiness, and what is being ready? And then who is being ready? And then as far as trying to hurry it up or being steadily sort of trying to steer yourself in that direction, is that actually possible? Or do you, is there a sort of a grace that has to happen along with that, that is... Because the grace to me is what seemed to steer or filled my experience for a little bit of it.
Got it.
There's a notion in our tradition that I found, I've kind of been reading some older source material that I find interesting that speaks to this question, that, you know, I don't know if I would say it's objectively true, but at my gut level it feels very right, and there's this notion of the magnetic center, which is that for whatever reason, and I'm not sure what that reason is, if some of us have a magnetic center, which means that the life never quite is fully satisfying, that you always know that there's something more, there's something beyond that, and that's what brings us or attracts us to spiritual work in some form or another. And it's sort of like, in the same way that iron filings will just be moved by the presence of a magnetic field, our magnetic center will respond to influences in our lives that bring us towards this kind of experience. And that to me is a mystery. You know, we could, you know, get a chalkboard and talk about all sorts of theories about how many lifetimes it is required to have a magnetic center. But the practical fact is that we can talk about these ideas with a group of people who really resonate with them, and there's lots and lots and lots of people in the world who, for whom, it's, you know, just kind of a waste of time. You know, they're busy doing whatever, you know, things in their lives that are important to them. So the magnetic center to me sort of captures that, both that sense of grace and that answer for me as to, well, why did it get directed in this, in the, you know, if I look honestly, there was always a thread there that I was progressively trying to move closer and closer to access to conditions where I could work on these kinds of problems.
Yeah, my teacher's teacher has written a lot of funny stuff about spiritual practice, and one of the ideas that is attempting to respond to this part of your question is something he called the Cosmic Office of Coincidence Control. And the Cosmic Office of Coincidence Control, in my own experience, I was conceived and met my spiritual teacher 24 years, I guess it would be 25 years later, in the same city block in San Francisco, completely coincidentally. I will definitely use the word seminal experiences in my existence of this body. So it was something that I only realized later, of course, this apparent synchrony that was meaningful for me. But in terms of your question, my experience has been no. And I'll freely grant that this is something that I've had to come to appreciate more and more and more deeply. Everyone's situation is so utterly unique with regard to the Office of Cosmic Coincidence Control that there's no predicting it ahead of time. They're simply responding to the gift of grace that you're given when you get it, and it's kind of like the old phrase about 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. So practice, spiritual practice, as we engage with it, because we try to do this self-observation meditation all the time in our lives, as much as we can. Nevertheless, for a shift to take place, such that that which was the tool using us becomes the tool we use instead, requires both the perspiration and the inspiration or grace.
I don't understand who the self that finally decides that they want to observe the fractured selves. Like, how do you know that's not the voice
that's a damn good question.
Yeah, that's a great question. That is actually a very difficult question to answer, because in a sense, we're kind of bootstrapping ourselves from this place of having these fragmentary eyes. Some of the eyes may be quite interested in spiritual work and be useful. I mean, they're useful allies. Some eyes may be interested in something else entirely, like buying a new car. And they may be useful if you need to drive across town, but they may not be useful for this particular program.
But one self decides which is useful.
The way I would put that is that there is functioning in us a self, an essential aspect of ourselves, that is something that we have when we're children. That there's something in us that is prior to the functioning of this egoic mechanism. Now, what happens is that gets covered over, protected, insulated, much like, you know, sort of like a cocoon is wrapped around a caterpillar.
But it's unchanging.
It has the capacity of growth, but it doesn't change a whole lot after the egoic structure has been wrapped over it. And so the challenge is that there's parts of ourselves, deeper parts of ourselves, that have that kind of unity, that partake of that kind of unity. And there are eyes in ourselves that may actually somehow be even somewhat closely connected with those parts of ourselves. And in a way that I don't quite have a good explanation for why that happens, the yearning to be something more helps inspire us to do the practices to create the space so that this essential part of ourselves can begin to grow again and can begin to contact life again and can become the part of ourselves that actually inspires our life, rather than being the subject of the mechanisms of the egoic structure. So it's I say bootstrap in a sense, because we all, you know, if it weren't possible to do, no one could do anything. If it weren't possible to start with this, in the state of this fragmentary existence, we wouldn't even be having a conversation. But we're not. There's openings. There's cracks in the armor, and it's through those cracks that we can continue to move in a particular direction. And if we do the work and we do the practice, then the conditions are created where it becomes progressively easier and easier to kind of grow beyond that, the functioning of the ego.
So let me give you a couple of hints about how that would happen. Number one, Stuart was saying that it's important to have the assistance of others who have gone before. That is, the context. We're primates. You know, you have to hang out with other monkeys who are interested in the same fruit that you happen to like. If the monkeys you're hanging out with are all going for the stuff on the ground, you're not going to be climbing up in the tree. Why go to the trouble? You know. So number one, you have to hang out with other primates that have a similar, at least direction. At least ostensibly. And number two, in terms of your internal process, your question spoke to how do you identify a true self, you know, a more something other than just a fragment. Well, one way to look at that. It's not the only way, and it's not 100% applicable, but it's very helpful, is that if it's speaking to you in your head, then it's a fragment. That is true. If it's speaking to you in your head, it's a fragment. Most of us have the experience of speaking with through the generation of voices in our head, which are also interacting, usually very fast, so that we're not aware of it, with a censoring, with various censoring fragments. Oh, better not say that to this person, although I'd love to say it to that person. You know, lots of stuff like that, and that's our experience. But I'm here to say that you don't have to. None of us has to think about anything before we speak. We can just let the words come out, as they sometimes do. Occasionally, you know, when lightning strikes, often enough. But that silence, that quality of silence, inner silence, is something that is a very good marker to help you know whether you're onto a fragment, you're being carried along by this fragment, or whether there might be something else happening. So, one helpful hint.
Would it be possible for you to talk more about the nature of the essential self?
Mm-hmm. So the idea of the essential self is that within us there's a natural self, there's a natural beingness that we find. You know, you don't have to look any further than looking at a baby, looking in their eyes. There's someone there. They may not have a sophisticated personality, but they have subjectivity. They experience. They have presence. And it's true that a child is subject to external factors in their bodies and things like that, so that they're not sort of in control. But there's a quality of purity there that we see. And part of that quality is not unlike what Rob was describing. It's presence and being in silence. Even if the baby's crying or laughing or whatever, there's still this sort of silent, open, receptive, sweet quality. And that is our essential self. Our essential selves as reflected in our minds, our hearts, our bodies, are a present part of ourselves. But when we begin to grow up and start to identify ourselves and put all of our attention into the functioning of the egoic structure, the android, it's like the information from the universe that would allow the essence to grow and to become more mature gets cut off, because we start to operate from and to sort of cling to a very limited repertoire of what to think, what to feel, what's supposed to be the case, how we take ourselves to be. And so the essence is, you know, there's only so far you can go in describing it. The conditions of practice are intended to create the conditions such that we can begin to discern for ourselves what in ourselves is essential and what in ourselves is acquired. And the essence grows, it changes. It's not like the super spiritual self necessarily. It's a very human aspect of ourselves. And for many people, you know, it gets stuck at around 2 years old, you know. So it has some of the qualities of a 2-year-old, which can be very lovely and also very annoying. But that's part of what has to be allowed out, so it can have experience of life, and we can have that, those parts of ourselves, those sort of pure immediate parts of ourselves, can start to have the confidence to be exposed to life without having to wrap themselves in an egoic structure for protection. So there's a quality of vulnerability, a quality of tentativeness that often comes with our encounters with the essential within ourselves. That's why, you know, the essential becomes, you know, is first encountered with, you know, when we open ourselves and begin to trust either friends, lovers, or a spiritual teacher. We have the possibility of being honest of what's really going on inside of ourselves. And yet with most people, we're just trained to, you know, layer lie upon lie upon lie about what's really happening in there. So the essential part is functioning, but it may not, you know, be getting much attention. So when we learn to begin to put attention on that part of ourselves, a flowering within can take place, and we can develop a strength of presence that has the possibility of kind of becoming the active part of our lives. But it takes time, because it's a very sensitive part of ourselves that we've numbed through layers and layers of defensive structures. So we have to kind of first unwrap those things and begin to learn how in practice to, if not entirely, make them go away, at least have the ability to kind of temporarily shut them off so we can see what's behind our defense.
So I want to do some show and tell in response to that question as well. There's a book just published called What is God by Jacob Needleman. I've just been reading it recently. It's very interesting. And at one point, he describes his experience as a teacher of philosophy at San Francisco State, sitting with his class and eliciting from them a list of qualities or states of human experience. There's I don't know if you can see this, but there's two pages, three columns each on each page of something like 20 things or more in each column, something like that. Nervous, overwhelmed, hungry, happiness, fear, love, anger, jealousy, envy, pity, gratitude, foolish, enthralled, disgust, dismayed, suspicious, defiant, rejected, confused, cautious, interested, bored, worthy, unworthy, grim, horny, reassured, scorned, frisky, discouraged, sly. This is just a small fragment of all these things. So he goes through and, with the agreement of the class, settles on another much shorter list. Compassion, humility, wonder, sorrow, grief, empathy, remorse, shattered. Okay. I contrast these sets of qualities to maybe highlight some of the things that one might look for that might distinguish the experience of the fragmentation of that, the page with all those different states, qualities, experiences, versus something that might arise more genuinely in and from the silence within as well as without. So maybe that would help too. And this book is for sale here in this store.
Even better.
Yes, we have two copies too.
Yes, sir.
And yet, I appreciate what you guys are saying, but yet at the same time, could it be imagined that instead of imagining or naming an essential self, that instead of there being a dancer, there's only dancing? Instead of breathing, there's only the breath, moving like the wind? And there really is no separation? There's only the illusion of this being a localization of consciousness in the body?
I mean, that's an interesting question, and you probably unmasked yourself as an Advaita Vedantin by saying that. And
that obvious?
Yeah. it's obvious. And I'll say that because, in a way, to me, the Advaita Vedanta, you know, discourse, it's a wrap, too. And what you're saying is not... I would agree with you in one sense, but I would also say that... what I've come to appreciate more in this work is that, you know, the non-duality is an aspect, fragmentation is an aspect. Neither one is complete. And often, from a Vedantic point of view, there's this idea that the non-dual is the ultimate. I'm not sure I buy that. It's like the fragmentary, or the sort of separation or being form, having the experience of individuality, is a mystery to me. And it's a mystery that's part of the creation. And it's, to me, that's an equally powerful part of our inheritance as human beings, as the non-duality. And so I see that both are important. I see that both are hold truths, and they can be brought together, that you can focus on one, you can focus on the other. Sometimes it depends on what one is working on in the particular moment. But there's a mystery about being an individual in relationship to the totality, just like there's a mystery about being undifferentiated from the totality. There's a great book that kind of touches on this thread by a spiritual teacher named Lee Lozowick called Enlightened Duality, which is also for sale in this store. And it's something of a response, because he doesn't deny the non-dual perspective, but at the same time he celebrates the finding ourselves immersed in duality, finding ourselves immersed as individuals in relationship to other individuals, to things. And there's a mystery there. And so the resolution for me of that mystery, in part, is that the essence is, and our essential selves and what we cultivate in ourselves, is this wonderful creation. I think of some fourth-way teachers, like a guy named A.H. Almas or Hamid Ali, calls it the pearl of great price, coming from the Sufi tradition. But there's a miracle that occurs when we can awaken ourselves as an individual soul in relationship to the totality, that knows itself as undifferentiated and yet partakes of individuality as well. And there's something organic about that relationship that is, to me, profound and beyond all the classifications of non-duality and duality. So that's my response to that, is I agree with you, and yet I think there's more.
Yeah, I guess I would say that I actually am very fond of using a terminology that points to process as opposed to a fixed thing, which is the tendency when you have a word like self. That's the tendency of the mind to go in that direction, and in fact, that's precisely not what we're trying to point to. But words are tricky tools, and that's part of this idea of the bricoleur, the person who picks up the appropriate tool at the moment, uses it for the appropriate task, and sets it down and picks up the next tool. So the non-duality terminology is precise, beautiful, and complete in one moment, and incomplete, fuzzy, and not helpful in another moment. Just as some of these other terminological, systems are as well. That would be my response. I don't think we have a fundamental disagreement in the general drift. But I do agree also with Stuart's point, and this is important, that it should be possible for the greatest Advaita or whatever master to be able to adopt the position that other people would understand to be duality, positionally, at a particular moment, and have no disagreement with it internally. None whatsoever. That's the trick, is to be able to hold two completely, three, four, many concepts, feelings, states simultaneously within these organisms without having their the conflict distracting one. The problem with the fragmentation is not the fact of fragmentation, assuming that you accept that there is fragmentation, but the problem with it is all this conflict happening, which prevents one from picking up the appropriate tool for this moment, setting it down so that you can be ready to go for the next moment. So that would be my response.
But you raised a point I guess I want to clarify. When we use a term like essence, it's not to be confused with the traditional philosophical term essence, which is a fixed thing. And that's not what we're saying. In fact,
we're still Buddhist.
Yeah, so I think from a Buddhist perspective, the self isn't separate and unconditioned by the rest of the creation. But that doesn't mean that practically speaking, there isn't something to contend with. And in that sense, the contending is part of the process or the work that we're talking about.
Right.
It's, you know, where we find ourselves this stream flowing through this great flux. So what do we do with it?
I wanted to call attention to nourishing the mystery, identifying in the mystery, identifying in that which disallows identification, won't allow it. Looking at the relationship between ego and survival mechanisms,
mm-hmm.
and we're in a system where survival is answer based, because to survive the education system you have to come up with answers to satisfy the teacher or to satisfy the test. So we have an answer-based mentality instead of a question-based mentality. So the survival organism or the surviving organism finds safety in knowing the answers, having the answers, and doesn't find all of that much safety in being able to really swim in the questions.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that reach that wanting to understand that which almost implicitly defies or will not allow understanding, refuses it,
mm-hmm.
and it's a shame because we're a culture that doesn't honor or doesn't nourish the mystery, doesn't value it that much, because you're going after the buck, the dollar, and the dollar is kind of like the answer, or looking for that relationship, and that relationship is going to be the answer.
Yeah, more practically, or just more generally, it's just looking for answers outside of ourselves.
Yes.
Looking for answers in the phenomenal, rather than turning backward to look within. And what you're saying, I think, is a reasonable capturing of a big function of the ego, which is to have an answer, to have a safe answer, and that's what identification is. You know, like you know what you're supposed to be, and you know you're supposed to be upset if someone disrespects you in the way you're being, and so then we know the way we're supposed to react and in all our situations.
I think it's possible to argue that, and this is my anthropological training informing some of this response to your question or comment, it's certainly possible to argue that the, and I think our founder Robert Ennis actually had this view, it's possible to argue that the development of the highly elaborated androids or egos that we find common in our society, but not just in our society, but generally across the planet at this point, is a very different experience of life than would have existed 10,000 years ago when people were living in groups of 100 or 200 people at most, usually, for the most part, or even less. And that all that complexity has generated has exacerbated a tendency of the human organism in a way that produces enormous even greater fragmentation than would happen otherwise. But I would also suggest for your consideration that even those folks in those idyllic societies, hunter-gatherer societies way back when, they had issues with these things too, number one. And number two, it's kind of like when you add numbers. I mean, we've got whatever it is, 7 billion this form of primate running around on an increasingly small planet at this point. It's hard not to have developed the challenge that we've created for ourselves. So it isn't the answer to my way of looking at it will not lie in shifting social structures or social mechanisms or not that that stuff doesn't affect how we experience life. One of my good friends and one of the most respected spiritual teachers I know makes a great point of having a context for children to grow up in his spiritual school, where they are nourished in a way that is different than the sort of situation that obtains in most schools, for example, and is a nourishing emotional environment where parents are assisted to offer, excuse me, a kind of openness to children than maybe we find in other contexts. But that all being said, you know, you can't just find a little desert island these days and get away from this bigger mystery that we've created together. This too is a mystery. It's a mystery why we had to have 7 billion people right now. I think. I don't see why it had to be this way. But here it is. Here we are, and this is what we've got. And that's what we face in our internal situations as well, our personal situations. It's a mystery. So let's use the tools that we can to address the internal mystery. Yeah?
Back to an answer-based or a question-based life. Rumi says to live the questions. And as you live the questions, you will gradually move into the answers. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about the answers, just live the questions.
Give no thought to the morrow.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
To live in the question?
Yeah, what does that mean?
There's so many things that seem to be unanswerable that you could go crazy worrying about them. But the questions, the journey is the thing, rather than having the answer. It's just moving along the journey and living the question.
But you still have to ask the question why, or the question why, right?
Yeah,
you still have to understand the system.
I can give you an example of a practice that is we sometimes use, and it's described in one of E.J. Gould's books. It's called a centrum of gravity question, and the practice is to take a working question. Now, this is a very practical exercise. It's not quite as broad end as we're talking about, but it might be a question about looking at what's important for you in a particular situation or in your life. But the idea is to hold the question not to find some closed form answer, but simply to hold the question as kind of an antenna to direct you to
make you sensitive.
Sensitive to kind of where the answers might come from. And so it's not unlike, you know, if you make something important and you hold the question up, but you're never really trying to answer it per se, or if you get an answer, you say thank you. Okay, next. You know, it's like you just reassert the question. Mm-hmm. It's not unlike the classic Ramana Maharshi discourse of "Who am I?" You know, that's a similar holding of a question and living the question as opposed to living the answer. Whereas, you know, the ego is, you say, "Who am I?" Well, I'm this right now, or actually, I'm this and only this until the next shot comes along.
Thank you. I met a 92-year-old woman who, in a group, we were talking about aging gracefully, and she was saying that being 92 was wonderful because she doesn't worry about anything anymore. She doesn't worry about the truck hitting her. So she just says every day is a blessing, and she accepts it. And so I was thinking about gratitude and that, you know, that spirit of just accepting each day and just being receptive mm-hmm. to, you know, all the beauty that surrounds us and all the goodness that comes to us and all the opportunities to create something.
I completely agree with that. Mm-hmm. But the question is, what happens when someone cuts you off and other impulses than gratitude arise? Okay? And that is where systematic practice and self-examination come into the picture. Because it's relatively easy to cultivate gratitude when there are no big challenges. But when there are challenges, that's where the pedal hits the metal, and that's where, to my way of looking at it, if we can expand consciousness at that point, then there's a possibility of not being just purely mechanical in response to those external circumstances.
I think traffic is a good example of that, and you're using that phraseology of cut me off and pedal on the metal.
Mm-hmm.
If someone cuts you off in traffic, mm-hmm. rising up in you is this
mm-hmm.
feeling of great anger and annoyance.
But yes.
That's when you could step outside yourself and say, or don't even say, look what I'm doing. Say, look what it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Is this necessary? Does it have to do this right now?
Mm-hmm.
And just step away from that.
Yeah, our practice of self-observation even dispenses with the although you can use that the additional are technically called work eyes of what am I doing, what's happening to me as an assist. But the basic procedure of self-observation is to establish within consciousness a silent witness that does not comment or participate in any of the normal, that list of, that I read from the Needleman book, does not participate in the sense of identifying with any of those qualities or states. It observes them unflinchingly with no hesitation, as much as we can assist it to do so.
Well, that's very interesting. But mm-hmm. I only say that because when I have these lovely little conversations, I tend to be a little bit more sort of, compassionate towards it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, I don't know this for a fact, but I wonder how much of the conversation that I have with my little voices impacts how I relate to your experience. So if I'm noticing that you're, or somebody's really hurting.
Yes.
And I see them not able to go through their experience in a way mm-hmm. that's supporting and growing.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, I could just say, just there you are, and be be pragmatic about it, and notice mm-hmm. it and observe it.
Yes.
And I don't know what's more helpful. Is that more helpful, or is it as helpful to be, and I only see it, and I'm talking about this, if I'm in relationship with somebody, having that mm-hmm. experience, a sense of a level of compassion there, as well as that sort of pragmatism, both, is that simultaneously possible?
I'm going to say neither and both in response to your question. So the trick is to realize what compassion is and isn't. We have a lot of habits of assuming that. Assuming what's happening in another person's experience, which are actually the product of projections about what we think is happening or would like to think is happening with another person. Sometimes there's a phenomenon that we call sympathy that arises. And sympathy can, for example, be a tool by which I establish that I know better than that person. I am more together. I am more compassionate. I am more aware, and that person is less. It can be very subtle, very subtle. So, but that's not compassion. Compassion is is open-hearted witnessing of the pain of the world without having to defend. That compassion must arise from a place where I witness my own pain as well as the pain of another, without having to change it to something else. Without having to change it to something else. Doesn't mean you might not say, oh, let me help you. You know, you need to take this. But it's not about, I'm talking about external stuff in the world, helping bodies be safe and healthy and happy. But that is not this, those two can exist simultaneously, but compassion is this open-hearted resonance with and acceptance of whatever's happening. And so that's why I'm saying neither and both. If we're not looking at things from this a witnessing viewpoint, then it's so easy to slip into some other near relative to compassion that is actually masquerading as something generous when it's not. And that gets very tricky. So, but the final thing I want to point out is it's not easy to open your heart and leave it bare. Just, you know, like the, I don't know, some of you may know the pictures of Hanuman in the Indian tradition. You just rip it open and there it is. Mm-hmm. And here I am in the world with no reservations to all its beauty as well as suffering simultaneously. Thank you.
I've been reading Sogyal Rinpoche, talking about the practice of Tonglen. Mm-hmm. And he's differentiating between compassion and pity.
Right.
Pity is where they're separate. They're separate from
right.
you.
Right.
And what you're really feeling inside is, gosh, I'm glad that's not happening to me.
Right. Exactly.
And he says exactly what you say, that compassion is just opening the heart completely.
Yeah.
And sort of empathy, mm-hmm. where...
It's a sense of connection, but it's not based on a projection.
No.
That's the trick. And it's a tricky thing, and that's why a practice where you're getting feedback about whether you are actually doing that as opposed to some even very well-meaning projection. Very well-meaning projection. It's so important to have this feedback of people who have been looking at these sorts of questions, seen it in themselves before, mm-hmm. and can offer real practical advice.
I keep giving suggestions about, you know, what if you're in a situation with someone who's suffering, mm-hmm. and it's someone you don't like, mm-hmm. and never have liked, mm-hmm. and how can you open your heart to compassion for mm-hmm. this person.
Uh-huh.
And of course he says then you have to use your imagination, you have to imagine it as though this person were someone you dearly loved, mm-hmm. and imagine what feeling you would have in that case and try to retain this feeling and express it.
It's in our tradition we call that acting as if.
Yeah. And he says that you can even use a dear friend and sort of superimpose their image on this person.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he says that when you do that, it brings merit to the friend you're using in that way, as well as helping the suffering person.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you. Question.
What would you say about the phenomenon where, when one comes to perceive the beauty and the suffering of the world as one and the same,
mm-hmm.
where you find yourself in a state where you're so rawly just witnessing everything,
mm-hmm.
that when there's suffering going on, you can remember that you would have perceived it as such, and you know that others perceive it as such, but you're perceiving it as beauty. Is that...
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you would say that that's problematic.
I would cut that Gordian knot by simply going back to the advice about silence that I was talking about there. It's not that these perceptions, these direct perceptions arise. The problem is we're so used to identifying with the procession of voices in our heads, the eyes in our heads, that when a space opens up and something else happens, the tendency is for this I to come in and create a story about it, a context to explain it. And then you're not there anymore. Then you're in some ego projection again, however mild, however, you know, exalted, and relatively enlarged a space of consciousness it happens to be. It is not the silence. It is not, as Michael is calling it, the mystery.
But okay. I wanted to add that what you're describing to me feels like the emotion of poignancy.
Yeah.
And poignancy is a very natural a feeling that I associate with compassion. That it has, there's an awareness of suffering at the same time there's an awareness of the beauty of the situation. And a good example of that, since you mentioned that you'd lost your father recently, my father died a couple of years ago, and or 3 years ago now, I guess, but his parting was a beautiful passing, and it was poignant in that there was his physical suffering, there was the beauty of the transcendental nature of what was happening, and it was all together, and it had a singularity, or it had a unified nature to it that I didn't have to cut apart with my mind to, you know, sort of figure out, should I do something here, or is this the right feeling, or anything like that. It was just part of the totality of that experience.
Well, the whole, like, should I do something here, that's kind of what I'm wondering about, because when you said you shouldn't stop yourself from necessarily physically helping someone,
mm-hmm.
I mean, what happened with me was I was in this state of direct perception when I was, mm-hmm. We were all helping build a rock wall, and a wheelbarrow of lava rocks fell on a 7-year-old child, and whereas everyone else ran to help him, I was in a state of just, you know, it is what it is. I wasn't perceiving it as problematic, and I immediately, my fear came in, because I was like, whereas, you know, I was, one of my eyes, like, popped its head up and was like, wait a minute, this is maybe not a good state to embody, because what are you doing to help other, you know, other people if you're not perceiving their pain as suffering? So I don't know if you're supposed to step in or just witness.
The process that I was describing is entirely internal. Okay, entirely internal. Stepping in, stepping out is stepping into or out of identification. Okay, it has nothing to say to what you do with your body, but when one gains experience with moving, normally these are rigid walls, boundaries between the fragments. When one gains the experience of being able to move through those walls more or less efficiently and effectively and at will, then it is more likely that one will be able to, that it will spontaneously arise to do with the body in every sense of the word, physically, emotionally, and or intellectually. And when I say the body here, I'm talking about the whole organism. Just want to make that point too. Then spontaneous action for a well-educated essential self, if you'll allow that term for a moment, can inform something that happens without thinking, absolutely without thinking. So there's no judgment. That's the thing about this quality of what we're calling the essential self, for lack of a better term right now, is there is no judgment there. There is, God does not judge us, in my view. And God does not judge us. We judge ourselves with the egoic mechanism.
But there's no reason you couldn't be fully functional and assisting in the situation as appropriately and still hold that a feeling and have that perception. And the from a work point of view, the other interesting question, again, this isn't coming from judgment, it's more just coming from objectively trying to see how one's organism is operating, is the arising of the feeling that you had actually a buffer against doing something, was that a sophisticated form of identification to keep you from actually being connected to the situation? I don't know the answer to that, but that's the kind of question we would hold an opening for, rather than assuming that I'm having this sort of quasi-spiritual experience. I mean, there's lots of people who have, you know, so-called spiritual experiences, and they use that as justifications for things they're not examining. And so, from a work perspective, you know, we just want to hold open the question, because it's certainly the case that it's possible to be completely functional in ordinary human terms and be useful in ordinary human terms and yet have a profound connection with the totality of the situation where you may be trying to help even though you know that there's no help to be had. Or your help is, in a sense, helping others to deal with the futility of the helping that they're mechanically trying to offer. But you're the one who has to be the judge of that, and there's no right or wrong in this. Because if your aim is to become more and more conscious, then right is simply peeling back the layers and understanding how can I function more. There might be a feeling of remorse that arises organically if one discovers that one could have done more than one did in a situation, but that just becomes inspiration to continue to focus and continue to deepen one's practice.
These are some good questions, and because this is these are real questions in terms of what do I do moment by moment to live the most beautiful life I can live. Our founder and teacher Robert Ennis used to say that spiritual practice was creating life as a work of art, and it is of course a work of art that is disappearing behind us like ink on the top of a river flowing past as we move through time. What kind of art are we creating? This witness that we're talking about is present to everything that happens, not just that we do with the organism, but everything that happens internally as well. That's part of the art. That's why it's art. You can't make only a science of this, even though many of the principles we've discussed tonight are in fact, you know, as codifiable as Hammurabi's law. But actually enacting it in the completely unpredictable circumstances of life, that's where it becomes a work of art. So, on that note, I'm thinking that's a good place to end. Thank you all so much for a wonderful evening. And we should point out that we do have a group meeting called, what's it called? Refuge of Presence Practice Group that meets here Tuesday evenings, the first three Tuesdays every month. We don't meet on the fourth Tuesday because another group meets here on that fourth Tuesday. But otherwise, so one, two, three, and five.
So we at Many Rivers have a Donna Bowl on the counter here. A portion of the donation goes to the store, and a portion goes to the speakers. But the speakers are the store tonight, so...
So they give it back
so
to
it
the
all,
store.
It all stays in the
so
store.
So this is your chance, two for one. We're matching grants.
Many Rivers.
And we want to move some product here, too. Yeah,
15% discount for anyone who wants this frog tonight.
Targ the trog. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And for if anybody's interested in Tayu events, a study group or workshops or whatever, you can talk to myself or...
We have a workshop on co-meditation happening this Saturday in South Sebastopol.
10 to 5.
At 10 to 5. We have the regular study group on Tuesday evenings and other events.
Yes.
So, thank you.
Thank you.
What? Oh, turn off the recorder.